Allison Crittenden is Director of Congressional Relations for the American Farm Bureau Federation. She grew up on a multi-generational fruit and vegetable farm here in Virginia and earned an ag econ degree from Virginia Tech. Allison worked for Representative Rick Crawford of Arkansas on the 2018 Farm Bill and truly understands the needs of Delta farmers. In her latest role, Allison has been an integral part of Farm Bureau's interactions with EPA and the Department of Labor, among other agencies that impact on your farm and factory life.
Speak with you all today. So Rob mentioned some of those labor costs, so we'll dive into that. But today we'll cover kind of where we are with the AWER and the H2A program currently, some of the regulatory proposals that are out there, and then go into a bit of a discussion as to why it is so challenging to get ag labor reform passed through Congress. So we'll carry on from there. It is no surprise to any of y'all that agriculture, let me get this to switch, faces a labor shortage. I think the rest of the U.S. economy is finally experiencing some of the workforce challenges that ag has long been facing. This chart here, it demonstrates the growth in the H2A program. And as you can see, in 2021, we surpassed over 300,000 H2A positions. And that demonstrates a 15.3% increase in H2A growth from the year before. So this number is really interesting and important because if any of y'all use the H2A program in the room, you know that this is a program that you don't really want to use, you have to use it. It's very expensive, there are a lot of regulations and rules you have to comply with. So folks don't use the H2A program unless they have to, unless there are no domestic workers available. So this chart shows that that situation with the lack of domestic workers, it's getting worse, and we are having greater labor shortages in which we're turning to our guest worker programs to fill. You know, one benefit I will say of the H2A program is that it is uncapped. I know a lot of y'all in the mills have to use the H2B workers, and unfortunately that comes along with the challenges with the cap. So one benefit of H2A is that this number can continue to grow as we need these employees, but we'll talk a little bit about all of the challenges with the H2A program as well. One of those major challenges is the requirement to pay employees the adverse effect wage rate, which has grown pretty tremendously in the last few years. So this chart here just looks at the AWER increase from 2021 to 2022. In Louisiana, your AWER went up almost 5%, at 4.8%. But on a national basis, if you were to average all of these wages together, all these wage regions together, the AWER's gone up 6.4%. And on a national basis, the AWER is 1556. So Louisiana, y'all are very fortunate to actually be kind of in the lower end of that bracket. And in this next chart, we'll see the range of states that are paying different wages. So what's really troubling here, and troubling for the ag economy, is that 20 states, now over 20 states, are paying more than $15 an hour for H2A workers. It's not that farmers don't want to pay their employees, but you know, you can only pay what the market allows. So at some point, we will perhaps cross over, and our labor expenses, on top of all of the other input expenses, will continue to grow where the market may not keep up. So this just demonstrates kind of where we are right now with the AWER range, and perhaps where things could continue to go. Looking here, this chart shows the five-year growth in the AWER. And as you can see, there's been some pretty tremendous growth in some states. So, you know, once again, we have a range because we have different regions. So when you're looking at these different regions over the last 5 years, the AWER has grown anywhere from 12% to 42% for some folks farming there. You know, this is just it's a challenge because your prices have to keep up in order for this to continue like this. I think another good data point is that, you know, the AWER is growing at a rate far greater than the rest of the U.S. economy. And when we look back at that, even just the one-year growth that we saw, it exceeded what the rest of the U.S. economy, the rate at which that grew, looking at the employment cost index. So the AWER is growing far greater, at a far greater pace than the rest of the U.S. economy. And unfortunately, I don't think the situation's going to improve anytime soon. Just recently, at the end of January, a comment period closed for a Department of Labor proposed rule regarding the adverse effect wage rate methodology. Under this methodology, it provided no wage relief whatsoever to help with some of the big growth we've seen in the last 5 years in particular. Instead, it actually would likely raise your labor costs. It creates different wage calculations based on the type of job that the farm or that the farm employee is doing. So for some of these occupations, you will have a single AWER that's based on the current methodology. But for other occupations on the farm, we move to a different wage setting method, the Occupational Employment Wage Statistics Survey. And those numbers are quite higher than what we are already getting out of the Farm Labor Survey. And another catch here is that if you have employees that are maybe doing jobs across different occupational classifications, then you have to assign the highest AWER for all applicable job opportunities. So if someone is only doing an OEWS wage job part of the time, it doesn't matter, you're paying that higher wage rate. So let's look a little bit deeper at, you know, what kinds of jobs would correspond to the different wage rates. Well, if you fit into any of these, which are some of your, I guess, more typical farm jobs, so to speak, then the wage methodology would virtually stay the same. It would still be derived with the Farm Labor Survey and would, you know, probably have similar growth to what we've seen with the AWER in the past. However, what changes is are your H2 employees that fall into any other category. So if it doesn't fit one of those codes that I just showed earlier, then you're subject to the OEWS set wages. So that could be just about anything else. But in particular, I think some of the wages that I want to point out are the kind of more manager positions, supervisors of particular importance to you all. I know the heavy tractor trailer drivers, and then construction laborers as well. So we can look at some of the data and see like how much of those OEWS wages correspond to the broader ag employment. So that's what this chart here shows. So approximately per the department's estimates and surveying, 90% of most jobs should fall into our AWER-based, FLS-based wages, although we still need some relief there. And then about 10% would fall to these OEWS wages under this proposed rule. You know, that share could be much higher though, depending on the type of agriculture that you're involved in, and depending on perhaps if some of your workers are doing, you know, jobs that go back and forth between the different wage classifications. So either way, it still leads to a pretty drastic increase in your labor expenses. So if you're looking at this chart here, we can look at data going backward and see, had this proposed rule been in place, what we would have been paying our H2A workers in these different occupations. So at the top, you see what the national average AWER was for that year. And then if you're looking down at the different job descriptions, these are occupational classifications that, should this proposed rule go into effect, would be subject to these different wages. So a few that I'll call to your attention, one and highlighted here, the tractor trailer drivers. You know, last year you would have been paying those individuals $23.32, and the average AWER for all of the U.S. was $13.99. So that's a pretty big difference in your labor costs. And of course, this is all you know, national statistics, national averages of all of the different AWERs and different SOCs. This would vary a bit by your state, but it gives you a clear picture of, you know, just how much your labor expenses could increase. I'm sure some of you all are doing the math in your head right now of how many tractor trailer drivers you have employed on your farm that would be subject to this, and how your wages might be going up and your labor expenses increasing. So on top of the labor expenses increasing, this new rule also has a really great administrative burden. And part of that is because, one, you're tracking all these different occupational classifications. keeping track of different, you know, employees and what jobs they're doing, making sure nobody does anything that would send them to a higher wage classification. But also because the two surveys that are used to set these wages come out at different times of the year. So the FLS is published and usually effective as of January 1st. So that's typically what most of you in H2A have, you know, used and experienced. But the OEWS wages come out and are effective as of July 1st. So likely when you're in the middle of your season and you've probably already set your, you know, contracts with your mill or whoever you're selling your product to, and then suddenly your wages could go up in the middle of your season. So that could also maybe create a little HR burden if only some of your employees suddenly got a very drastic wage, right? You know, big increase halfway through the year, and then the folks who are subject to the FLS AWER are staying stagnant. So a lot of problems could arise from those two surveys not coming out at the same time. So that kind of wraps up on the proposed rule, but unfortunately the Department of Labor has not only been working on a new methodology for the AWER, but OSHA has also taken the first step to begin a rulemaking process to develop a heat illness standard. So the comment period for the OSHA heat illness advance notice of proposed rulemaking closed on January 26th. So as the AWER rule was the notice of proposed rulemaking, so the department was basically saying, this is what we're thinking about doing, let us know your thoughts. With the advance notice of proposed rulemaking, this is an even more preliminary step in that rulemaking process. So what OSHA was doing here is they were kind of putting out a lot of different ideas for discussion and trying to justify the need to then develop a proposed rule in which another comment period will present itself. But in this, they talked about all kinds of different topics, like making sure your workers take, you know, certain breaks if they're not acclimated to the climate, mandating specific time in shade should there be a particular temperature that day, and also how do you measure the temperature? You know, do you use an app on your phone? Do you use a certain type of thermometer? How do you account for humidity, cloud cover, breeze, different regions? You know, certainly it's pretty hot and humid in Louisiana in July, but it probably feels a lot different in Oregon or somewhere that's, you know, maybe a cooler climate. So these are some of the ideas that were discussed in this rulemaking, and, you know, certainly you can see that OSHA is gearing up towards having a pretty specific standard from some of the ideas that they were sharing. And just for awareness, this not only applies to outdoor, but also indoor workplaces. So it also talked about some of the other statewide heat illness programs currently in place. So currently Minnesota, Washington, California, and Oregon, they already have heat illness standards that were set in place by their state governments. You know, they've also in this outline, you know, the supposed number of heat illness deaths in order to justify the need for this rulemaking. However, over, I think it was from 2000 to 2010, there were just about 3 deaths per 1 million workers in the ag industry, you know, looking at it from a statistical standpoint. You know, certainly one death is one death too many, but I think when you're, you know, weighing the particular circumstances around a heat illness death, you know, maybe it doesn't warrant a very stringent one-size-fits-all regulation. In this rulemaking, it was also interesting because OSHA talked about the ways that they were already enforcing heat illness on farms and other workplaces. They cited how they've used the general duty clause to issue citations. They talked about the recent heat emphasis program and that they were, you know, already ramping up inspection and enforcement pertinent to heat illness. So in our AFBF comments, you know, we said back to OSHA, it seems strange you think that you need another, you know, more stringent rule here when you demonstrated you can already issue citations and enforce when, you know, proper mitigations aren't taking place. Moving over to the State Department, though, we could see increases in order to obtain H-2A workers. So the State Department has proposed to increase fees for all petition-based non-immigrant visas. The current number they're proposing is going from $190 per visa to $310. So just for your awareness, this is a fee that is paid by the employer no later than at the time a visa appointment is set at the U.S. consulate or embassy, and it's non-refundable. The worker, you know, if they pay the NIV fee for a particular worker, you can't transfer it. If something happens at the consulate and that worker is no longer able to come, you're out of the money. So this is another area where costs could increase once again on top of AWER increases and already providing, you know, free housing and transportation to your employees at no cost. So just want to flag this for you all. The comment period for this is still open, so if you're interested, you can provide comments to the State Department on this proposal until the end of this month. So we have a lot of regulatory problems right now. This administration has been incredibly busy pumping out regulations and proposed rules. But what hasn't been as active of late is the legislative conversation on ag labor. So we did have the Farm Workforce Modernization Act pass the House in March of last year. That vote was 247-174. By and large, still pretty heavy on the Democrats, but you did have 30 Republicans cross over to support. And as you can see, one Democrat, 174 Republicans opposed. You know, this legislation, I will say AFPF did not support it. We did have some pretty severe concerns with it. First being it created a new litigation risk for H-2A employers. Second, its wage methodology also did little to minimize the increases that we've already seen, and it also further embraced some of the disaggregated, separated wage structures similar to what we're seeing in this proposed rule. In this legislation, it actually broke just about every job down into a different wage classification. It did try to grant year-round access, which for those of y'all in the H-2A program, you know right now, you can't use the H-2A program for any kind of year-round work. But unfortunately, it placed a cap on the number of year-round visas made available, and that cap was far too low. Without any of these major changes to the guest worker program, it still required that farmers would have to adhere to E-Verify, and that was at a timeline before our year-round cap would be at a level in which we could be comfortable. And then finally, some of the provisions concerning status adjustment for currently undocumented workers presented a situation where some of your H-2A workers could potentially be displaced by a certified ag worker, which was the title given to those who were previously undocumented in this legislation. So with that displacement, similar situation to if, you know, you all had a referral of a domestic person, domestic worker, to fill an H-2A slot. And this legislation currently, unless your particular H-2A worker has been with you 3 out of the last 4 years, a call worker could come in and fill your H-2A position. You know, certainly we think that ag's already facing an ag labor shortage, so I think these call workers, these newly adjusted status workers, will have an opportunity to find employment without you know, jeopardizing your longstanding H-2A workers in those positions. And also, you know, without compromising the certainty that you get from using the H-2A program, especially with the contract requirements there. So this legislation passed the House, albeit quite imperfect. And after that, we did have some activity in the Senate, albeit brief. So after that bill passed, Senators Crapo and Bennett, Senator Crapo is a Republican out of Idaho, and Senator Bennett, a Democrat from Colorado, issued this joint statement applauding the House passage of the Farm Workforce Modernization Act and signaling their interest in putting together their own version of the bill. Early conversations included Senator Tillis from North Carolina, Republican, as well as Senator Feinstein's office, Democrat from California. She's long been involved in immigration conversations. But at this point, we haven't seen a bill. We've not really seen an outline of a bill, and much of those productive conversations have been derailed by partisanship, unfortunately. So what are some of these partisan issues we've been facing? So the border complications, it's really hard right now for Republican members of Congress to embrace legislation that may grant what some may call amnesty, to currently undocumented people, when you're seeing headlines like this about, how we've hit records of border arrests and how there's a lack of new border security being installed. So on the Republican side, that is a major complication that's derailing their involvement. On the Dem side, House Democrats passed the Build Back Better Act on a strictly partisan vote. This is what's called a reconciliation bill. So they use kind of budget tools in order to then get around in the Senate the 60-vote threshold that you would need to pass legislation in the Senate. So in the House, they can just have a simple majority and it can be voted on and passed, and that's what they did. And in that legislation, on top of a lot of the human infrastructure, as it's been dubbed, and very large spending social reforms, it also included provisions to legalize certain groups of individuals currently in this country. What's interesting, though, is on the Senate side, when a bill is to pass via reconciliation, it has to meet the rules and requirements of what's called the Byrd Rule, or as Hill staff have dubbed it, it has to make it through the Byrd Bath. Mm-hmm. And the determiner, the referee of all of this is the Senate parliamentarian, and she is a nonpartisan position. She's essentially the umpire. She's calling balls and strikes. And what she's determined is that these immigration provisions, as included in the House passed bill, are not fit to be included in the Senate version, as they do not have a primary budget nexus and instead are legislating far more than they should be. So Democrats have tried to rewrite this in a way, and they keep presenting to her plans B and C and D to try to include these immigration provisions. Every time she says this is not, supposed to be in a reconciliation bill, these immigration provisions have, far greater consequences, and they must be dealt, with the 60 votes and go through normal order. So, albeit that those immigration provisions are likely not going to see the light of day, and I think Senator Manchin has also, done a pretty good job of stopping the progress of this legislation. Unfortunately, Democrats, while they were pursuing that partisan approach, had little interest in engaging in a bipartisan manner to discuss issues like ag labor reform. And I think, this little chart here explains kind of where ag is, and really we're caught in the middle, because with the Republicans, there's a strong emphasis on border security, making sure we don't have incentives for illegal immigration. They also are warming up to guest worker reform, which is great, but I think that also comes with the requirement for E-Verify. On the Dem side, there's a strong interest in addressing existing undocumented populations, and what might be suitable for legal status for them could end up with a pathway to citizenship, which Republicans would likely balk at, or as a whole would balk at. And in general, I think they're very pro more immigration. And then ag's caught right in the middle, right? Because we need H-2A reform, and in a lot of places, we also need status adjustment of undocumented workers. So it's quite a challenge peeling off those folks who are willing to come into the middle so we can finally solve our problem. And I think another thing to mention too is that it's very rare for an ag waiver bill to come up on its own and pass on its own. And generally it ends up getting tagged along to a broader immigration package in an effort to gain a few more votes. So at times it can be an afterthought as well. So with that, I think we'll turn over to some questions, but thank you all.
Microphone, that way you guys don't have to pass back and forth. I'll start with questions for you.
All right.
I'm going to get Jack up there so we can see him.
Okay, well, thank you. Appreciate it, Avery. Allison, I'll start with you so we're not ping-ponging the microphone here. Have you noticed a shift in how this administration views the H-2A program versus how the previous administration did?
Yes. I think they recognize that guest workers are an important part of the economy and our workforce, but they also prioritize, you know, worker protections. They certainly have the ear of the labor unions. There's a bust of Cesar Chavez in the Oval Office. So there's a understanding of the importance of the H-2A program, but I also think that this administration is not as concerned about whether or not, you know, the folks who are employing these H-2A workers have the financial viability to continue to do so with that. They're not hampered by rules and regulations, in their efforts to comply with the program. There's definitely more of a worker-first mentality, I think, when looking at our guest worker programs with this administration. Whereas I think in the previous administration, a lot of the focus was, the Trump administration recognized that we needed guest workers, but I think there's always there were some in the administration that thought that perhaps guest workers were displacing American workers. So that was another issue that we had to contend with, is that narrative. And I think now the flip side is still very much worried about the domestic workforce and their potential displacement, but it's also coupled with wanting to make the program harder to use, more expensive to use, which presents some challenges for ag employers.
And Allison politely doesn't mention that the current Secretary of Labor is the first card-carrying union member in recent history to hold that post.
Yes.
How does this proposed wage rule contribute to the potential overtime implications for certain occupations like our sugarcane haulers?
So, there's a lot going on right now, on the legal front with regards to hauling and overtime implications. But I think we're getting, it's a slippery slope because you're starting to parcel out in this proposed rule, what kinds of tasks are considered farming and their wages should be derived by a methodology based on USDA data. And then they're parceling out the other positions like your agricultural haulers and saying that, these wages should be higher. They're not, the same as someone, picking and planting crops, and therefore they should be set by a wage setting, statistic based from the Department of Labor surveying. So I just get very concerned as we start to create a delineation between certain farm jobs and what that could mean for, ag's current overtime exemption. Very concerned that it does start to, not that we would agree with it, but it could create a scenario where certain types of ag work are no longer considered ag work per, overtime exemptions.
Great. One other question. Do you think ag labor reform will come together in this Congress, and what could it take?
Things can always happen. They can always come together. But I think one other complication that we're starting to walk into is that it's now an election year. And I think if you turn on the news, read the headlines, immigration's a really hot topic to campaign on. And it's, since it's a hot topic to campaign on, the issue needs to continue and not be solved for folks to be able to talk about it. if Congress were to solve immigration as a whole, then it removes a talking point for, you know, each side and something they're campaigning on. I think that, you know, should there be a groundswell, you know, from farmers asking for Congress to take up meaningful ag labor reform, and we left them maybe with absolutely no choice, that it could, you know, it would maybe happen, but I would also be worried that we put ourselves in a position where we're willing to accept compromises that maybe aren't as good for us in the long term. You know, we've been trying to fix, you know, the last immigration bill, you know, since it passed in 1986 with IRCA. And folks have been trying to work through the challenges that have arisen from that legislation since before I was born. So I think we have to be careful in how we pursue ag labor reform to make sure that we create a long-term solution and not a Band-Aid.
Thank you very much, Allison. Rob, I will turn to you now. The 16 price for raw sugar has been steadily creeping up over the past year. You've been in your job for a year, coincidence. Do you anticipate that that will continue?
Sorry, what was that? How did you end that, Jack? I missed that.
I asked, do you think it will, the trend of the 16 price is steadily creeping up, will continue?
That's a great question, and for all of you that have positions in the market, what I say here has absolutely no bearing on those positions. But certainly we can see from a global perspective that that effective cap rate on the number 16 is expected, at least for the foreseeable year, to remain high. Certainly all the international agents or groups that are forecasting global prices for the next year expect them to, you know, remain in that 20 cent area, which is keeps that cap high on the number 16. So, and that's for a couple of reasons. One, as I mentioned, Brazil is having dryness right now in their areas where they produce sugar. The recovery from COVID is keeping energy prices up or pushing up on them as you know, global economic growth continues, and that's going to induce countries like India and Brazil to move some of their sugar into ethanol production. Again, keeping that number 11 price high. And as that price remains high, that's going to keep the number 16 potentially high as well. So I would say at least for the next year, and certainly futures prices are suggesting this, it will stay in that 36, 37 cent range, at least through the first half of 2022, and then even, you know, 35 or 36 cents for the second half of 2022.
Rob, we hear from our sugar users that the prices are too high. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I tried talking about that just a little bit, just to hint at how we respond to that. Certainly, you all can see what the prices are, and they're higher than they have been. That doesn't mean that your margins or your ability to you know, to make the balance sheet work is also a guarantee. I mean, we know, tried to track how input costs have been rising. Certainly this year is going to see much higher input costs for all commodities, and sugar is no different. So, you know, I would try and pivot the discussion if we were talking between, you know, the American Sugar Alliance and the Sugar Users Association, if they were to bring up this point, I would certainly talk, you know, more about the challenges that you all are facing as you look at the upcoming year and hiring labor, talking about some of the difficulties in getting workers on your operation for specific tasks, the amount of wages that you're having to pay them, and focus on the margin discussion. So while prices may be at 36 cents or what have you, certainly the cost of production have risen at the same time. So that's where I go. And I know that folks at LSU have done a good job at sort of trying to develop that enterprise budget. And certainly I would point to some of that research as a, you know, corroborating evidence for that point. And the folks up north in Butte Country are facing the same situation.
Rod, over the last year, you've had numerous conversations with folks in the industry for the introduction. And I was wondering, based on those conversations and your own experiences, what do you see as the main challenges facing our industry as we head into the next Farm Bill?
Yeah, Farm Bill is coming. Certainly folks are expecting it's going to take longer than it's not right around the corner, but certainly discussions are here already. The folks on the Hill are already talking about what's working, what's not working in the different titles. We'll get engaged in that discussion along with our other organizations in Washington, like the Farm Bureau. And they certainly just had their conference in Atlanta and talked a lot about this. But for our industry, the main challenge is going to obviously be dealing with, like you always do, weather conditions. So, this past year turned out great for most operators, not everyone. Certainly strengthening crop insurance is going to be part of that discussion as well. We have to make sure that folks protect, for example, in Louisiana that are expanding into cane production for the first time, have some backstop for a bad year that may hit them. They may not have the reserves and be able to deal with that. I know USDA has put together a good package for hurricane insurance that may help. But freeze is another one that we'll be looking at going forward. So certainly dealing with weather conditions, and that's no surprise to all of you, but I think this input cost factor will play into the discussion in the Farm Bill. At this, generally when you go into a Farm Bill discussion and farm income is high, it's difficult to argue for positive changes in the commodity titles just because a lot of producers aren't banging on doors. And that's why the upcoming opportunity for some of you all to participate in the fly-ins is going to be important, to sort of talk to folks up there about the challenges you're facing this coming year in terms of just being able to get the labor you need, to be able to afford the inputs that you're going to need to put in the field, as well as continued advances in plant chemistry and dealing with those other challenges that you all are going to probably be talking about tomorrow. So, Jack, with that, I could probably go on for a while, but I know we had some hands in the audience, so I'll stop there and see if, I don't know if we have time for other questions, but.
We will turn this over to Jim so that he can take some of those questions. And before I give up the throne here, I do appreciate both of you for both the wealth of knowledge that you have, your presentation today, and all your hard work for agriculture. Thank you.
Questions? I know, Bubba, you had a question.
Yeah, I think everybody in the room is seeing this wave situation. They're serious. They're serious. So, my question is, worst case scenario, they do come up with this, pay the truck drivers one price, pay the tractor drivers another price. That's discriminatory, really. Because in the real world, all of these H2A guys, they can drive a truck, they can drive a tractor. So, has anybody addressed how that's gonna work? Can you split a guy up and say, hey, you drive a tractor sometimes, you drive a truck another time, going to try and keep it even, because really it's discriminating, and it's going to be a big issue.
Yes. Allison talked a good bit about the comment period. The league just compiled extensive comments. We had legal counsel help us. We pointed out all of those things. As we know it, there are probably 50 or 60 comments that were made on the proposed rule. Our folks are looking at those comments to understand what everyone else is saying, but I know that the American Sugarcane League voiced concerns about how do you split a worker? How do you manage all that? Allison talked a little bit about it. I know Brian Bro, Louisiana Farm Bureau, commented on those things, and I'll let Allison talk a little bit to that.
Yeah, Well, I think what you just said is why we are so concerned with this proposed rule. You know, it's interesting that an administration that is so concerned about employees and workers and a Department of Labor that's headed up by someone who's a proud union member would take away mobility for H-2A employees to gain new skills and move up, you know, in your farm businesses. But what really happens with this, you know, different wage structure is there will never be an opportunity for folks that are, you know, employed to do more of the on-farm jobs to, you know, maybe learn the ropes of driving a truck on a slower day, because you can't put them in the truck without suddenly doubling their pay. So I will say that we share those exact concerns. What it creates is, you know, they're trying to make ag like a factory where, you know, everybody has one job. And unfortunately, it just shows that the bureaucrats writing these rules clearly aren't spending a lot of time on farms. They don't realize it's an all-hands-on-deck approach. And they don't realize that, you know, in any given day, even in an hour, you may have employees that are engaged in tasks that would cross back and forth across those different, you know, wage-setting mechanisms.
Discussion of prevailing wage is, does anybody ever look at what the prevailing wages are in these people's country of origin? I mean, what does $20 an hour in the United States place you in terms of the average hourly wages in Mexico?
Yeah, that's something we often point that out in comments, and I know several of the organizations that commented did. You know, I think what we hear from most folks, and even when I talk to the H-2A workers employed on my father's farm, they're very quick to tell me that, you know, what they make in, you know, in an hour here, they maybe make in a day if they're lucky in Mexico. And I think an argument that needs to continue to be made is, you know, much of these funds are, you know, a direct transfer of money to these other countries. And they help these countries that are, you know, in a really bad way, suddenly have an infusion of dollars to spend, and it helps their economies. But that often gets lost in the conversation, and instead we get to a point where we're pricing out the ag employers here in the United States, and we're, you know, with these folks who are working on our farms will lose those opportunities to come here and make a good wage and then have their families, you know, live a pretty good life back in their home country. So that gets lost. I think the other thing on the flip side of that is this argument that the reason we don't have domestic farm workers anymore is because we're not paying them enough. And that's certainly not true. You know, under the H-2A program, you have referral requirements. If a domestic employee wants to come work on your farm, then you pretty much have to hire them if they meet the job qualifications. And right now, I'd say wages are pretty high in the H-2A program, and we're seeing continued growth in the program. So our workforce shortages are only growing, and we're just, you know, further hampering farmers' ability to continue their jobs by increasing these wage rates like this.
With this change in whether drivers would be paid more, if you participated in the H-2A program, would it also mean that any domestic driver would have to be paid that same rate?
That's my understanding. You know, under current regulations and rules for the H-2A program, you have to pay your H-2A workers and other employees in corresponding employment the same wage. So if you had those same people to same tasks, and that would lead to them being paid the same rate.
I don't want to leave Rob out of this, Jim, so I'm going to ask Rob a question. Looking at where we are and your knowledge of the USDA, do you feel any threat that we're going to try to attack the 16 price somewhat by allowing a little bit more in, or do you feel good where that differential is?
That's a great question, and certainly something that we focus on continually with the folks at USDA. We continue to point out there's a couple provisions there that we remind them of continually, which is can't be increasing any kind of TRQ before April 1st is one, and the other one is We're in our 13.5 to 15.5 range, so there's no need to do anything extraordinary as long as it's within that range. So those are always our positions going into discussions with the USDA. USDA is looking at and hearing from you know, participants in the sugar market that prices are outside of the range for what they you would expect for a 14.4 stocks to use ratio, and it's too high for that range. And why is that? And I point out there's a lot of things going on with COVID right now. I try to talk about some of them. That's that would be my response. You know, transportation bottlenecks, what have you. And they're scratching their head because they're getting pressure. You know, I'm just talking for the folks at USDA are getting pressure from not just us to not change anything, but from others that are asking to them to do some of those actions that you're alluding to. So I think we're just based on policy grounds, we're in a good place because precedent would suggest that they let the program run as intended without any changes as long as we're in this range. And I think we're going to keep on focusing on that. Do I worry about it? Certainly I worry about it. I think the more we can talk about margins and highlight the fact that even though prices are what they are, that doesn't mean that producers are able to make it work for some of the issues that we're talking about today. I think that's a good story for us, just to continue to remind pretty people at USDA that you've got to go out and, you know, purchase inputs for this coming year. This is how much a harvester costs. This is the issue we're facing with respect to wages, et cetera, that you need to have prices where they are in order to make it work. So, anyways.
Allison, explain what happened after February 28th. I mean, who reads through the decisions? How do they come about? Who's the they in this whole process?
So with regards to the visa fee increase comment period, or kind of just all of them in general, so what the departments have to do is they'll go through all these comments that were submitted, and they will use that feedback as they're developing their final rule. In the case of the AWER or in the case of the heat illness situation, they'll use that feedback as they're developing their proposed rule. And the department generally responds to a lot of the concerns and claims as outlined in the comments. So, you know, it's always interesting when you read through the final rule to see where they pulled information and how they're utilizing it that you submitted. So, you know, they'll make reference to, oh, American Farm Bureau said XYZ, and, you know, several other ag groups, and they'll name them, you know, shared the same opinion. And they'll say, although they said this, you know, our position is this should be the regulation and this is why. So they have to go through the process of reading them, acknowledging that they've read them, and then incorporating, you know, the comments submitted by the public into their final rule. I will say that this process can very often take a lot of time, which I think right now, with looking at everything that's, you know, currently proposed, that's good for us. So I don't think we want to see any of this come to fruition anytime soon. So on the heat illness, I think, you know, we have a significant amount of time before we would ever have a final rule, you know, ready for implementation. And I'm thinking well over a year. I'd be surprised if they got anything together any quicker than that. I think with the AWER, I'm sure they are working and want to have a final rule implemented ahead of 2023. I think it's a foregone conclusion for this year that they would have a new wage rule, but I'm sure that that's the deadline that they're working with. And then with this visa fee increase, that could get turned around a bit quicker. You know, it's, I think the department can say that, you know, oh, we need more funds because there's, you know, more employees coming through our consulates coming to the U.S. So they'll come up with their own arguments. But it is really important to be part of groups that are submitting comments, because that's how your voice is heard in the regulatory process, and the departments do have to look through those comments that are submitted.
Thank you.
And I'll just add one more thing, too. In the reg process, you also have the ability to go in and meet with OMB. So you can request a meeting to make the same. You can submit comments, and they've got to respond to those comments. But you can also request a meeting, and they're required to take those meetings. And you can go in and make your point in person, too.
Any other questions? If not, we'll just move right along. But obviously, you know, we the American Sugarcane League, works in conjunction with a number of organizations, and on this, particularly on the wage and labor issues, it's crucially important that we form coalitions. The league and sugar can't do it on our own, and so we lean very heavily on American Farm Bureau, obviously. In listening to Allison speak on those issues, she's very, very knowledgeable, and we're fortunate to have folks like that working on our behalf. With regards to Chad's question, with regards to reaching into USDA and making sure they understand what we do and our arguments and how we try to supply USDA with information, Dr. Johansson talked about his 1 year hiatus from USDA. You know, once you're hired, once you hire a federal employee, they have to take a 1 year hiatus where they can't communicate with their prior agency. And so Chad, Dr. Johansson's 1 year anniversary is just up. So we're expecting him to be able to make sure that USDA is well informed. So with that, we'll wrap up the session.